for 17 million and they want to firm prices up, they better put the production down to 16 million and then they'll get some firmness. But as long as somebody's there with 2 million barrels or 15 million barrels, as you're talking about, is available, trying to sell it, because they've got something of the same problem that Alaska has, is they got themselves up on a spending spree and they need the income to keep them going. And so they're selling oil wherever they can. Perhaps there's tankers sitting around anywhere on the spot market. Yeah, here's a load of oil. What do you give me for? And at any given time, there's that kind of oil available putting the pressure. Now, is that the so-called glut or not?
Well, I think you should ask, say, Milton Lipton about that when he comes on. But I think you've got it figured out, sir. I think that is basically the problem that the market has.
Sam, did you want to respond?
From the first 9 months of 1981, OPEC production was at 23 million barrels per day. So that they have now dropped down to 17 million, which is a 6 million barrel per day drop in production. That drop is greater than either of the two declines or three declines we've had in oil consumption each year. Trying to take account of all these seasonal factors and noise in the data and all the rest, it gets really hard to know exactly whether the market is in balance or not. It's very difficult to find out. And the biggest clue as to what's going on is to simply look at the spot petroleum product prices and spot crude prices. If they continue to go down in the next few weeks, then the production cuts are not adequate. Period.
You mentioned, if I may, Mr. Chairman,
continue.
You mentioned earlier that there'd been a firmness in the spot market prices. How many days has that firmness that you alluded to prevailed?
About 2 to 3 weeks.
2 to 3 weeks. It started then actually before the OPEC meeting of 10
yes,
days.
Yes, right.
Representative Meekins and
Well, I'd like to ask a couple questions about the spot market that I don't understand. Is that, you know, there's a lot of the companies and a lot of the buyers, I suppose, have long-term or at least more than, you know, have contracts that extend for some period of time. I don't know whether you say they're long-term or not, so that they don't have to go to the spot market, and I would assume that's the case. And so who is it that's going to the spot market? I mean, for instance, the individual, the need of an individual purchaser who doesn't have a contract, and, you know, he may bid up or bid down the price, for that matter, depending on his own circumstances in the spot market. And it may not, the spot market may not be representative of the total market, or maybe totally different. Isn't that, I mean, I'm not explaining this very well. What I'm saying is that, you know, what are the characteristics? Is everybody going to the spot market for some portion of theirs, or is it just certain buyers? Because if it's just certain buyers, then it wouldn't be necessarily reflective of the general situation. And even if there was a reduction in the spot market, that may be just the supply and demand characteristics of the spot market and not of petroleum as a whole. You see, I'm trying to make a distinction between.
I firmly believe that a two-week lull in the decline isn't terribly significant. But there's no doubt that when prices are going down, the spot market is a better place to buy oil than the long-term contract. And when prices are going up, you are in real trouble if you have to depend on the spot market. There are companies right now that don't have long-term contracts that are making a lot or losing less money, perhaps we should say, than those that have those long-term Aramco contracts. And I think, again, Milton Lipton probably has a better handle on this than I do, but it's clear that from the data that we've developed that the Aramco partners are losing money on those long-term contracts that they've had. In the past, they've said, well, stability is what this business needs. We have huge investments in the structure and in the market, and we need assured supplies. And they've been willing to pay a premium in order to get it, because when things were tough, the issue was on the other foot, and Saudi Arabia helped them out. Didn't help them out, it honored its contracts. Sam, you want
to? The answer to your question is, of course, days long. It's a complex market. I'd make a couple points about it. One is that the structure of the spot market is changing radically and very fast, in part because of the introduction of a futures market in New York for petroleum, for heating oil, and now gasoline. And that's expanding to Chicago and has also expanded to London. And to some some extent, this is opening up the commodity market for oil, and I think in the future you're going to see less contract trading and more spot trading. It's one of the structural changes that's occurring. It's also a structural change likely to make the oil industry more competitive and therefore pricing more erratic up and down. The second point about all of that is the most important point for the impact of the spot market on crude oil pricing, which is what you're concerned about, is that in charting out the prices in real terms over the since 1979, changes in petroleum product prices, and in particular in the margin or the difference between a composite barrel of petroleum products sold on the spot market and crude oil prices, invariably precede a change in crude oil prices in almost a one-for-one ratio. About 30 to 60 days following a price rise in the product market, you're going to see a rise in the average crude oil price. Not just spot crude prices track much faster, but average crude prices come up, and vice versa. When product prices go down, average crude prices come down 30 days to 60 days
later. Well, it's the vice versa that I'm, Mr. Chairman, if I could continue, that I'm concerned about, because I think it's because the spot market has been such a good bellwether of changes in the overall market that we've all sort of looked at that as a sort of a leading indicator, essentially, of what's going on in the regular, in the total petroleum market. But when there's a shortage, probably almost everybody is trying to get a little more oil in the spot market, and so therefore it's very competitive, and the price is likely to be bid up, and then that's going to have a reflection in the other prices when the contracts are renegotiated or whatever. But on the other hand, I'm not sure it goes the same way on the way down. That's what my question is, because I don't know. I'm just making these kind of judgments, because if a lot of the buyers, not everybody, but a large portion of the buyers, especially the majors, have contracts that are satisfying their needs, then they're not going to be accessing the spot market. So the spot market there's not as many people and there's not as many buyers in it as there would be during a shortage. And consequently, that's why the price will fall, but it doesn't necessarily follow, does it, that that's going to be reflected in the negotiated contracts. I don't know that it would. I'm just saying.
It already is to some extent in that when crude spot or petroleum product spot prices fell and crude prices, the spot prices fell, it was followed by a lot of official oil, not OPEC oil necessarily, prices falling, for example, British Petroleum, and the announcement by Ohio's production of ANS. They have realigned now as to what should be a solid market price of $30, but the OPEC has not yet gone down from their 34 to 30, and therefore the strain's on it. But I think that the behavior in a downside market, if you're right, we don't know much about that. The periods in which petroleum product prices have fallen in 75, 76 relative to crude were so slight, a few cents a barrel, that we just don't know how the markets behave under those conditions. In the period since 1979, there's been two downturns. Average crude oil prices signaled preceded by downturns in petroleum product prices, but the effect has been really slight.
Yeah, none of them have approached the magnitude of the decline we are seeing right now in that other chart.
What I was getting at is that, and I think you've answered my question, but for instance, to make an extreme argument that I'm sure doesn't fit reality, but if this entire surplus that Representative Bedsworth was talking about in terms of the 2 or 3 million were find its way into the spot market, well, certainly it'd be very depressed price in the spot market. But on the other hand, the people, if the buyers in the regular market were satisfied with what the amount they were receiving and didn't want to change that number, there'd be no pressure in that market, assuming it's somewhat separate than the spot market, for that price to be negotiated downward, except if any of the countries wanted to take advantage of this trend to try to increase their sales somehow by undercutting. But it just seems to me that not necessarily that it flows through as easily on the downside as it does on the high side, because then the countries have a real incentive. They look at the spot market and it's at 42 and they're at 32 and they say, well, let's raise it $4 a barrel, and there's a lot of hawks in OPEC that would do that.
Greg had a point I think he wants to add, but the spot market is not quite as thin, I think, as you believe it is. It's true that not many petroleum products trade or crude trades in spot trading, but with the advent of the futures market, an enormous amount of paper trades. And those future trades are all set at prices today and future prices. And the trading around those prices is millions of barrels. It's all paper trading, but it's important because that
every piece of paper has the potential to mean a transfer of oil.
Okay. Thank you.
And this is an institutional change that did not exist in 75, 76, so therefore it may not be this, you know, we don't know, again, how it will behave. We didn't have a future fund in 76.
Representative Helfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You both kind of touched on this hypothetical 2 or 3 million barrels a day, but it seems like there's an answer there that's not being reached. Production can't be that far off of consumption for that length of time. Now here you've got shut-in production, so that's admitted non-production. But isn't an awful large portion of that 2 to 3 million barrels a day really the result of falsely representing true production?
Could very well be.
There are lots of incentives to not tell the truth when you're running a cartel. That's one of the real problems of a cartel, is that you really don't know what you're next door neighbor is really doing. And you don't have any real good way to enforce any allocation of the pain.
Well, inventories are not increasing, probably declining.
They do not appear
and
to be increasing.
Production is indicating 2 to 3 million barrels a day ahead of consumption. It's just not there.
You've encountered one of the problems that oil economists have lived with.
This quarter is a historic low for consumption. The swing is around 6 million barrels between the peaks and the troughs. So just because, netting out all these seasonal effects, particularly when you're not even sure how the conservation is impacting seasonality, et cetera, all of it is very, very difficult.
A lot of noise in the data, as we say.
Let's switch a minute to Alaska crude. There was an article recently on a North Slope oil prices that was sold in the West Coast, going, I think, in March, approximately $26.92 per barrel. In April, we estimate that to go down someplace between $26.25 to $26.50. What is your thoughts on this? Is this going to go further than that with the North Slope crude? What's your thoughts on it? And then what would you like, I'd like you to do is, on that $26, how much does transportation cost in the pipeline from Valdez also to the West Coast, and how much is actually sold at?
Well, in our forecast, reflects the conclusion that the West Coast prices, just like all other oil prices, are going to decline and decline precipitously. We also, as part of our forecast, analyzed the incentives to maintain the current differential between oil being delivered to the U.S. Gulf Coast and oil being delivered to the U.S. West Coast. As you are aware, Alaska receives substantially more at the wellhead if the barrel is destined for the West Coast of the U.S. than it receives if it is destined for the Gulf Coast of the U.S. That differential right now actually went up a bit. I perceive that differential is under great stress as price comes down, primarily because of the windfall profits tax incentive. As the price drops below the windfall profits ceiling, which is in the neighborhood of $16, the producers suddenly see a much greater incentive to maximize the return on each barrel of oil. At the present time, if you lose a dollar by shipping the oil to the Gulf Coast instead of to the West Coast of the U.S., the producer only loses about 10 cents. when they drop below that ceiling, the producer will lose $1 or for each dollar that the price is different. And that will create a great deal more incentive to ensure that that oil gets to the maximizing market. And I see competition breaking out between those markets and those prices gradually equalizing. I don't know exactly how fast it will occur, but I think it will be pretty much completely equalized by the end of the year. That is the fiscal year. You asked about prices for the cost of the transportation. In the past, we did the Department of Revenue did an analysis of the differential between the ANS spot price on the U.S. Gulf Coast and ANS wellhead prices, and it tracks pretty closely at $10 a barrel. We believe that that's going to increase to about $11 a barrel by the end of FY83. Did you have another question in there, Mr. Chairman, that I...
What do you see the per barrel coming down to from on a North Slope crude? As it stays today, it's approximately $26.50 to 92 cents. What's your low on the North Slope oil price crude?
Well, as we showed in our distribution here, we said $7 at the for a 30% probability at the wellhead, and we feel that there's on average about $11 transportation cost, 7 and 11 is 18, 13 plus 11 is 24. Lucky.
When it gets, when the oil gets so low that we cannot afford to produce it due to the high cost of the production field, do you see any chance the federal come to play in this with federal regulations?
I do.
When do you see that?
If you notice, this is kind of steep here. That's the reason it is kind of steep here. We drew this steeply because we believe that below a U.S. price of about $15 or $16 a barrel, that there will be a great many forces that will act to induce the federal government to either impose an import fee or some other action that would, number one, compensate for the losses in the windfall profits tax that the federal government is going to incur as a consequence of such a rundown, if it indeed occurs. There are a whole host of other forces in the economy and in the body politic, I guess one might say, that would act both for and against that. And one might find a rather unusual coalition in favor of that. The environmentalists, along with the oil companies, environmentalists would not want to see prices drop so low that the conservation efforts, in their view, might die out or not be pursued as aggressively. And so, in answer to your question, yes, indeed, I do think that that is a possibility, and that if it wasn't for that possibility, we would have drawn this curve much more, with a slope more like that.
Is there any further questions? If not, I thank you both, Sam and Greg, for your time here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
At this time, we're going to take up, we're supposed to have Tom Williams, the Commissioner of Revenue, but here in its place is Dr. Lear.
Actually, you got Joe Donahue.
Joe Donahue?
Fine.
Okay. What we'd like to hear from you is your comments regarding the world oil prices and also the state's revenue forecast, not only for this coming year, but also for future years. Mr. Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Donahue. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. Last Friday, the Department of Revenue released the results of its March revenue forecast, which showed a sharp downward revision in projected near-term revenues. That reduction in net unrestricted revenues totaled almost $1.7 billion less for the FY82, FY83 period than the department had previously forecast for the same period in January. This decrease is a function of both the state's total dependence on petroleum revenues, which are in turn directly related to the price of crude oil, and to the fact that the world crude oil markets have recently been in a state of total disarray. Those markets remain highly unsettled in the wake of the abrupt plunge of crude oil prices, $4 to $5 a barrel, during this last quarter. The sudden reaction of the market to oversupply conditions, which have been worsening over the past 2 years, caught many analysts by surprise and has spawned numerous articles in trade magazines and newspapers predicting the demise of OPEC and heralding the return of inexpensive crude oil. OPEC met in special session on March 19th and 20th in an attempt to coordinate a response to the worsening price situation, but their reduction in the OPEC production ceiling to 17.5 million barrels a day was seen by most analysts as being ineffectual given the current low levels of demand and the immense world inventories. As a result, the March 1982 petroleum revenue forecast projects average expected revenues, which are dramatically lower than those projected in December 1981, when it was expected that prices would fall on average $1 to $1.50 a barrel over the next 12 months. Although January prices for ANS crude at Pump Station 1 averaged over $21 a barrel, current posted prices by Sohio of $27.75 at the Gulf Coast and $27.50 at the West Coast suggest prices for March will average closer to $18 a barrel. March spot market quotes as low as $26 a barrel suggest prices will drop further over the next several months. Primary factors influencing our short-term forecast include extremely weak demand for crude oil, which persists even in the face of falling prices, and relatively harsh weather conditions in northern hemisphere countries, and which continue to confound the current supply imbalance in world crude oil markets. Considerable uncertainty exists about when and if demand will turn around. Conflicting reports about the rate of crude oil stock drawdown abound, and there is disagreement among the experts about the extent to which the general economic recession is dampening demand and the extent to which price-induced conservation and fuel substitution have resulted in structural changes in the demand for petroleum and petroleum products. The president of Exxon has been quoted recently as characterizing speculation about the future for crude oil demand as similar to solving Rubik's Cube without the instruction manual. OPEC's recently announced intention to limit their production to 17.5 million barrels a day is perceived by the department to be insufficient to bring supply and demand into balance around the current market price of $34 for Saudi Arabian light crude oil. In the United States, crude oil stocks currently available in private hands and in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve amount to some 629 million barrels, or enough oil to go 8 months without importing a single barrel of oil at current levels of demand. For this reason, the March 1982 projections assume on average very low prices for crude oil throughout FY83. In addition, given the current impasse with respect to resolution of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline tariff issue, either before FERC or by negotiated settlement, we have left the pipeline tariff at the current $6 per barrel weighted average throughout our forecast horizon. This represents an increase of nearly $1 a barrel over our December 1981 projection, which had assumed some resolution by January 1, 1983. This tends to further lower our price assumptions for the wellhead price of Alaska North Slope crude. Average expected total production revenues for FY82 are down 9%, or approximately $301 million from December 1981 projections, which include an 8% drop of $139 million in projected severance tax collections and a 10% drop, or $161 million in projected royalty payments. Average expected total production revenues for FY83 are down 39%, or $1,384 million, which includes a 38% drop of $699 million in projected severance tax collections and a 39% drop of $685 million in projected royalty payments. For the intermediate term, the recent history of the 1970s would suggest that over the next 5 years, we can expect generally modest price growth for crude oil, with the possibility of major supply interruptions causing short-term price run-ups. The March 1982 forecast projects that crude oil prices will bottom out in FY83 and subsequently rise slowly through FY86. Although significant weakness in price seems likely in the short run, prices should increase over time due to the following factors. First, the tendency of the modern Western economies to inflation raises the cost of finding and producing new oil reserves, increases the cost of alternative energy technology, and puts pressure on owners of crude oil resources to increase their prices. Second, the fact that the majority of accessible proven crude oil reserves lie in either the politically volatile Middle East or the Soviet Union, therefore leaves Western nations subject to the risk of major supply interruptions. Third, crude oil will cost more as the stock of known reserves is extracted, and increasingly more expensive sources of oil are explored and produced. The real uncertainty over the intermediate term is whether and when vigorous demand growth will resume. To a certain extent, the tremendous crude oil prices increases of the last decade resulted in structural changes in energy use, such as the switch to fuel-efficient automobiles, better insulated homes, and utility fuel conversions. These developments suggest very low demand growth. It is also quite possible that stable or falling real oil prices will act as the primary stimulus to an economic recovery over the next few years, which suggests renewed demand growth. The fact remains that in a very short time, most analysts have come full circle from a view of demand pushing up against limited supply to one of demand-constrained production. The recent downturn in oil prices has illustrated quite dramatically the extent to which state revenues are susceptible to swings in the world market on the downside as well as the upside. For this reason, it is felt that given future uncertainty about price, the costs of erring on the high side are greater than being too conservative. Therefore, for FY84 and beyond, the department will be reporting revenues corresponding to the 30% cumulative distribution as our single point estimate of future collections. These risk-adjusted petroleum production revenues for FY84 are projected to be $2,380,000,000, or a decrease of $1,979,000,000, or 45% from December. Likewise, decreases for FY85 and FY86 approximate 45 and 44% from the December forecast. The long-term portion of our forecast covers the period of FY87 through FY98. The most significant factors affecting the state of Alaska petroleum production revenues during this period are the following. First, the effect of a prolonged period of cheaper crude oil on the demand for that product. Second, the effect of lower current price expectations on the timing and further exploration and development of potential and known hydrocarbon-bearing provinces in Arctic Alaska. Third, the timing and extent of decreased production at Prudhoe Bay. And fourth, whether or not the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation System is built. Revenues are expected to increase in terms of nominal dollars until the FY1989, but inflation will greatly reduce the purchasing power of the dollars in the future. The significantly reduced assumptions for long-range price growth and the decision to report revenue projections less than the calculated mean result in FY1987 through FY1997 revenues, which are down 51%, or a total of $42 billion from the forecast for the same or similar period last December. In addition to the impact of these assumptions on royalty and severance tax revenues, two other significant items should be mentioned. First, state investment earnings for FY83 have been revised downward from $315 million to $200 million for a decrease of $115 million for that year, due to the fact that the general fund balance will be significantly less than previously calculated. Secondly, revenues from the state's corporate income tax will also be significantly reduced. The estimated petroleum corporate income tax revenues for FY82 have been reduced by $29 million from $713 to $684 million, and for FY83 they have been cut by $46 million from $304 million to $258 million, for the same reasons which relate to the prolonged period of oversupply built into the department's most recent forecast. Finally, even the estimated general corporate tax revenues have been reduced by a total of $5 million for the FY82, FY83 periods due to the impact of the Federal Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981, which allows more rapid depreciation methods, which are in turn incorporated by reference into the state law. In summary, the Department of Revenue's March forecast projects the following net unrestricted revenues for the near term. For FY82, the March forecast projects $4,044.4 million. This is down $291.4 million from the January forecast. For FY83, the department projects $2,747.7 million, which is down almost $1.4 billion from January. The news contained in the March forecast is sobering, but it should provide us all with some very valuable lessons concerning the difficulties and risks of trying to engage long-term developmental planning with a revenue base totally dependent on international market forces which are beyond the state's control. In the short term, at least, the revenue decline presents primarily a problem of reduced expectations requiring a realistic reappraisal of our state spending priorities. That concludes my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Donahue. Representative Cotton.
So Ohio price on the Gulf Coast, you said $27.75 and $27.50 on the West Coast. What about Exxon and ARCO? What's the most recent data you have on their prices on those two places?
I believe they're still $2 higher. I'm not sure whether they've responded to Ohio's market change yet.
Could you expand on that a little bit? Why there is such a difference, and do you expect it to remain that way?
So Ohio basically sells to third parties, and ARCO basically sells to its own refinery. So there's a lag time built into its book calculations.
Same with Exxon.
Pardon me.
Same. You say ARCO sells it to its own refineries.
Primarily.
Okay, I don't have anything else. And now I wanted to ask on your figures on comparison of the March estimates to the December 81 estimates for the period of FY87 to 97, you show that your revenue projections expect 51% less. Have you done an analysis for that same period of time comparing the March estimates or the December estimates, either one, with what would have been income to the state under the old 4321 tax law?
No, the department has never developed department's methodology for predicting 4321 was a rule of thumb, 3/4 of severance tax revenues, which was never refined much more than that. So it could be generated from our petroleum revenue forecast, but we've never done that.
Would you do that?
We could do that.
Would you? I'm asking for it now, so you can you take that as a request and
sure.
Give it back to us? Okay, thank you.
Representative Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe, in your remarks there, you suggested a strategy for making the revenue estimates based on the fact that it's more difficult to deal with, lower revenues and projected than higher ones, that for fiscal year 84, the policy of the department was going to be to project revenues using the 30 percentile numbers. Is that right?
That's true.
And I happen to agree with the argument that it is harder to deal with declining revenues and revenues that have come out lower than anticipated. But why, and I noticed in this paper that was distributed that 30% figures were included for 82 and 83, but why change the policy in 84 when we're dealing with a problem during fiscal year 82? Why say not for fiscal 83, the department doesn't recommend we use a 30th percentile figure?
It's essentially an estimate based on degree of certainty. The shorter the the period of the forecast, I think the more reliable and more comfortable we feel with the mean case. Obviously, that we've been proven wrong in the past several forecasts, so that's not an overwhelmingly convincing argument, but it is the way we feel.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. Well, on that, does that mean then when next year, when the revenues are presented to the legislature for fiscal year 84, at that time you'll be using the 50th percentile, but right now you're only projecting 84 revenues at 30th percentile? Or what does that mean? I don't understand.
In terms of a consistent policy, I believe the 50% case would be used for the 2-year period, and 30% would be beyond that.
Okay, well, is your argument then, because fiscal 83 is not so far away in the future as fiscal 84, that at this time we should use the 50th percentile for fiscal 83 and the 30th percentile for some other year, 84, or that next year the policy is going to change, at least based on the information I have now, that probably the policy should change for all future years? In other words, you're saying in projection of revenue streams for the state that we should apply a higher discount figure to uncertainty figure to years further in the future, or that we should shift next year to a 30th percentile figure. I don't understand what the suggestion is. Elaborate a little bit.
Well, the Department of Revenue's historically produced its forecast on the basis of its mean expectations, and it's believed that because of the tremendous uncertainty in the oil markets, that going beyond a year and a half using a mean becomes very high risk, and therefore it's safer to use the lower numbers. It's my understanding that Shell Oil Company last Friday, and Shell is perceived as one of the best managed major producers, their economic section refused to come out with a forecast over the next for the short term. If that's true, that represents the basically the experts throwing their hands up and trying to wait out the next year before they make another judgment in this area. It doesn't preclude the legislature, the governor's office, or anyone else from using the 30th percent case for FY82, FY83. Those numbers can and will be provided, and may or may not be the I don't know whether the governor's office has developed a position as to which numbers they would use. I'm not sure whether the legislature has had an opportunity to develop a policy in that area.
Continue.
Yeah, well, just provided as a matter of information in the attached to the memorandum that was distributed dated March 26, and the last page does provide 30% figures for current future fiscal year, that, you know, I agree. I think probably most of the members of the committee would say that it's lots harder to deal with revenues that are substantially below what projections were than revenues that are above those. And I think the legislature should give consideration to shading the 50% figures for both fiscal year 83 and possibly 82. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Follow what Representative Malone just said, since it's harder to change the budgets as the forecast revenues decline. What is the state going to look at for the next quarter? Is this the state going to look at the next quarter? The revised forecast going to stay at 2.7 for April, May, and June?
We would certainly hope so.
But you
for 2.7 for FY83.
Is that your bottom figure?
That's our bottom figure.
Is there any further questions, Representative Meekins?
Well, actually, your bottom figure is that's your 50%.
Sure.
So the bottom figure would be lower than that even right now. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Another couple questions. I noticed some interesting on this run, if this is the in the handout, if this is accurate. this, of the, I noticed that some of the three major sources of income, oil and gas production, severance taxes, going from last year's 1579, or this current year, you're predicting 1579.33, and it's estimated to go down to 1120, which is about a 20% decrease. I'm just, I don't have a calculator, so I'm just sort of eyeballing that. And also, you're in royalties from 1137 to 811, a reduction of about 25%. Yet in corporate petroleum income taxes, it's estimated to go down from 684 to 258. And in fact, in 1981, the actual was even higher at 860. So substantial reduction there from the 82 estimate to the 83 estimate, reduction of about 60% approximately. And I'm just wondering, since royalty is really tied to price more than maybe anything else directly, since we get, you know, we sell our royalty all at a certain price, and if price goes down, we get less. So it's directly related to price, and it's only, you're only showing it going down about, excuse me, about 25%. How is it that corporate petroleum taxes go down so much, and what are the assumptions that lead to that?
The primary reason for the drop between 1982 and 1983 estimates is the fact that in last year, the state was returned to a modified apportionment approach towards calculating corporate income and income tax liability. And so the 4321, which was kind of a net proceeds severance tax, if you will, generated significantly more monies than the new methodology will. That particular tax was approach was abandoned in conjunction with an increase in the severance tax, 12.25% to 15%, which was designed to more or less offset the reduction in this corporate income tax.
Oh, I see. So, do these numbers indicate to you that that's happened, or does it looks to me like it didn't? And I'm just, I know you haven't run that analysis yet, but they're both going down.
They're both going down. The new corporate income tax, because it looks at sales of refined products rather than crude oil prices, is probably acting as a buffer and going down more slowly than the old 4321 would have. 4321 would probably still be generating more nominal dollars, even though it would decline more dramatically.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one more question. I'm just wondering if this, I find in your document here a lot of explanation of the dramatic swings that by now we're all real familiar with here, both on the upside and the downside. And this is sort of an official recognition of that. I mean, I think it's been recognized before, but in any case, if they hadn't, this is certainly an official recognition of our dependence on that one commodity and the dramatic swings that it can give us in our revenues. And in fact, you've indicated one response to that is to start predicting at the 30th percentile of confidence, whatever it is. And I'm just wondering, maybe this is a question for Dr. Lehrer or you, either one. Has there been any thought about any other measures, such as some sort of rainy day account increase or something like that, to account for these, to try to protect us from these swings? We've got this short run problem that we're dealing with here, but it looks like this is going to be a problem for some undetermined period of time, maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, maybe longer, that we're going to be on this yo-yo and getting these revenue shocks every time something happens in the Middle East or elsewhere. And it just seems prudent that we would try to adjust to that. And you have, in sense of going to 30%, but that's not the same thing as some sort of buffer. And I'm just wondering if you any thinking of that in any official way, or if it hasn't come up yet, or what's the situation.
So I'll have to defer to Dr. Lehrer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, of course, the major thrust of our effort now has been to figure out how to get to 83, as opposed to how to deal with 84 and 85. I think Representative Meekins brings up a good point. Just off the top of my head, I hadn't thought about it before, but one thing a person could do is, for instance, to appropriate only to the 30th percentile and put the other 20% on the rainy day fund. Or for sure, you always set that aside. So when we eventually get it, well, probably the optimal is where you base next year's budget on last year's revenues. Then, you know, even though you could still have large swings in the budget, at least you'd know it's going to become an issue.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Cotton.
Of course, we couldn't get there from here this year, right?
Not likely this year.
Joe, just on your remarks here on the last part of Representative Meekin's question, obviously the receipts from the oil and gas production tax would have been quite a bit lower had not, that would have fallen even more had we not, in an effort to balance that out, if we hadn't raised it from 12.25% to 15%. Right. I asked about the projections for FY 87 through 97, but I didn't ask about the revenue estimates for FY 82, 83 as compared to what they would have been under conditions had we not passed the, Senate bill? The Department of Revenue.
Yes, there's a memo, I think January 13th from the commissioner, which indicates $211 million for FY 82, 83, and I believe Mr. Barker extrapolated $411 million by including
FY 84.
We are in the process of trying to update that analysis in response to requests we've received from Representative Halford, and we've indicated that we would try to get that to him as soon as we got the March forecast firm numbers in place, and we hope to do that by the middle of the week. The
middle of this week, you should have that.
Is there any further questions?
Well, I just wanted to just follow up to make sure you see what I'm getting at. I mean, we've seen some different charts and graphs that showed, for instance, maybe I can just do it this way. Under the previously existing statutes, the revenues would have looked something like that. It would have been somehow stable. And under, after we passed Senate Bill 524, the first couple of years, it looked like it was going to decrease a little bit. And then when we got to 87, one graph shows us hitting about a skid about like that. So that's why I'm trying to understand if that still is close to being accurate, and that's why I asked for the two sets of projections. First, between 87 and 97, and then apparently the same one that Representative Halford asked for. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with this?
Well, I know in 1987, I believe the L factor would kick back in, which was removed from Prudhoe Bay calculations by SB 524 and probably is responsible for some of that drop. Under no existing or known set of severance tax laws, would the revenues have been stable over the last couple of years? They would have been under the old tax structure, including the 12.25% severance tax with an L factor and the old 4321, there still would have been dramatic declines in revenue.
Okay, I'll give you that. But I was saying that you had to use something as a base. So this was the old law. So under the new law, compared to what we would have taken under the previous 4321. I wasn't trying to suggest that this would have kept on a straight line either. Obviously, that would have gone down as well, speaking relatively.
Right. Are you done, Representative Cotton? Representative Chekwa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's been interesting keeping up with the events of the oil crisis and how it affects Alaska. You ever heard the old saying that goes something like this, how the rich people play it? In order to get back at somebody you don't like, you don't necessarily have to blow their head off, but you can make them suffer economically if you can afford to do it. You ever heard that old saying? No? What have we been hearing today? There's some speculation involving what may be affecting the turn of the events. Now, I've been involved in one industry. It's a statewide and a worldwide industry, for that matter. and people said, say there's high rates of interest, high cost of this and that, and giving all kinds of reasons to justify why it's a failing industry, when in fact it is very important to the world. And through different cartels and formation of disc corporations to enter into America, they have successfully used the act of quote-unquote conspiracy to channel or to direct the to have an impact on economy here in America and even in Alaska. Now, I don't know if anybody would be willing to come up forthright out and say that, but listening to some speculation given, said earlier, you would appear to me there may be some activity behind the scenes. I may be a little bit speculative at the moment as well. But judging from those comments, is there a possibility of a conspiracy going on in your view as to how it affects the revenues or the price in oil, Alaskan oil?
The only expressed conspiracy that exists is the, to my knowledge, is OPEC itself, which is a cartel which meets openly and sets prices. And so therefore it's not a behind closed doors sort of conspiracy. They are publicly and internationally trying to control prices and market forces, arguably unsuccessfully at the moment.
What about the activity of the state, like so-called unfair practices of the state in corporate oil taxes? Would that have any bearing by accepting Alaska?
Are you referring to the possibility of antitrust conspiracies amongst the oil companies themselves, or tax evasion? Or
well,
both?
I'm not referring to anything specific. Just,
I would be unaware of.
Would there be any possible effects from that sort of activity that we're involved in?
There are possible effects from conspiracies of that sort, I imagine, but I don't believe that they exist.
Thank you.
So any further question? Just before you go, is there any bills the administration would like back from House Finance? Any appropriation bills? We thank you for your time, Dr. Lear and Mr. Donahue. We're going to take a 15-minute break, and then we're going to come back in and hear Milton Lipton for the rest of the afternoon. We'll recess for 15 minutes. Continuing on this afternoon, we have Mr. Milton Lipton, who is the president of W.J. Levy Consultant Corporation and is also a petroleum economist. We welcome you back again and for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, gentlemen of the committee. I had planned, as always, to tell you how pleased I was to be invited back. But after listening to the previous testimony before this committee, I'm not so sure that it's an unadulterated pleasure. I'm also struck, of course, by how similar the projections of the various witnesses was, particularly as they are based upon an expectation of world oil prices, because when you're all done with their various projections, I didn't hear anybody saying that there was any substantial probability of a world oil price any higher over the next year or 18 months than something in the low 20s. It was a figure that emerged. Of course, I'm struck always by how rapidly conventional wisdom tends to turn around. It wasn't so many years ago that we heard most commonly expressed the fact that the world was going to be running out of oil by the middle 1980s if Saudi Arabia didn't produce 20 million barrels a day of oil. And now, of course, what we hear most commonly expressed is that we are facing surpluses into the 1990s and beyond, and that there is no hope of holding world oil prices unless Saudi Arabia produces something under 6 million barrels a day. And one wonders, I think it's fair to say that all of us tend to see the future through the prism of the present. We're conditioned by what we're seeing close in and what we're experiencing. But I think it's also fair to ask what the dramatic changes in basic circumstances might be that we suddenly see the world having turned topsy-turvy in so short a period of time. Now, I suspect that I probably have less interesting things to tell you than you have questions to ask. And so I'm going to run through relatively quickly what I consider to be some of the highlights dealing with first why we are where we are, and then what you're particularly interested in hearing, where do I think we're going from here. And I would very much appreciate or welcome questions from you as I go along, or comments from you as I go along, or even arguments from you as I go along. So I'm going to talk first about what we consider to be the reason for where we are, and where do we go from here. Now, what are the causes of the present crisis of falling prices? That's interesting. A crisis of declining prices. We know about crises of rising prices. All of a sudden, for the first time, we're confronted, not for the first time, but the first time in the modern petroleum age with a crisis of falling prices. We had a crisis of falling prices in the 1930s also. Look, some of them are very, very obvious, and I won't spend a lot of time going over them. There's conservation. This has caught hold and has burgeoned over the years as a reaction against the explosive price increases of 1973-74 and again of 1979 and 1980. There's the substitution of other forms of energy for petroleum. There's the economic slowdown which has taken place, not just the recession of recent years, but the general expectation most widely held that once oil prices shot up to the explosive heights that they did, that the economic rates of growth of the industrialized world would slow down. One was no longer projecting the historical rates of growth, but 2-2.5% was the best that we could hope for, half of what it had been previously, all because of the big increase in oil prices, and then of course the interposition of economic recession, which came in 75 and 76, and which came again began in 1980, 81, going into 1982. And then, of course, the overhang of inventories. So we have all of these things, and none of them together would have brought us to where we are. None of them by itself would have brought us to where we are. It took the combination of all of them, the juxtaposition of conservation and substitution and economic slowdown, recession, and the overhang of inventories, plus one other thing. The particular role which Saudi Arabia played in 1981 and which has brought us to the point where we are today. So if I may, I want to say a few words about Saudi Arabia in this whole area of within OPEC and as a swing force with respect to international oil movements and international oil prices. First of all, for the sake of emphasis, let me just make this point, that Saudi Arabia does not have an oil policy. I don't think Saudi Arabia never did have an oil policy, certainly not in isolation. Saudi Arabia has political purposes. and it will utilize its oil policy from time to time in order to serve its political purposes. Secondly, you know as well as I do, and I don't have to emphasize what it is, the major political purpose of Saudi Arabia, like that of any government, is to perpetuate itself, and in this case it represents a dynasty. And in that respect, they believe, and believe correctly, that the most important defense of the Saudi Arab position in the world depends upon the importance of their oil to the industrialized world. The industrialized world needs Saudi Arab oil. The Arab world around them covets Saudi Arab oil revenues. And it's the industrialized world that is so keenly interested and concerned about the uninterrupted flow of oil from Saudi Arabia yesterday and today and for 20 and 25 years or more into the future that has the same interest as Saudi Arabia about stability in the Middle East. Most of their Arab neighbors are much more interested in instability, having their own pretensions and their own objectives, which if they were ever exercised in the form of pan-Arabism, the way Nasser tried to promote it, or the radicalism of an Iraq or a Syria would leave the Saudi Arab dynasty tremendously exposed. And so, their major concern is that they be seen and understood to be a constructive force for the industrialized world, which is why they have, ever since 1974, pitched their own oil policy towards moderating explosive price increases and towards, except in the case of the Arab oil embargo in 73-74, and towards trying to assure the industrialized world that they can be counted on to supply the essential needs of industry in the industrialized world if something goes wrong elsewhere. So opposition to explosive price increases and the ability to supply when other things go wrong is the way in which the Saudis have presented themselves to the industrialized world. Now, in 1908, they were not altogether successful in projecting this image, not in 1975 when they first resisted and then acquiesced in OPEC price increase, not in 77 when they said, we only go up 5%, the rest of OPEC went up 10%. They had to concede the 10%. Not in 1979 and 80 when they tried to stop the big explosive price increases, were unable to do it. But in 1981, they saw the opportunity. And the opportunity arose out of the conjuncture of other circumstances I was talking about. The fact that we had had conservation, we had slackening of demand, we had had substitution, we had an overhang of inventories, and the Saudis took advantage of this to try to bring down the extremely high prices of the more militant members of OPEC who had gotten away with it in 79 and 80 during a period of tight crude oil balances. And they did that by underpricing and overproducing. Fine. The purpose was clear, and as a matter of fact, Yamani, in the circumstances of the time, was able to come to the United States, appear on nationwide television, and say, we, Saudi Arabia, engineered the glut. Well, can you imagine how that translates into Arabic in the Middle East? But his ability to do this was the fact that the rest of the Arabic world was in disarray. Iran, a Muslim country but not Arabic, was in the throes of a revolution. Iraq and Iran were at war. Syria was up to its ears in Lebanon, etc. So they were able to do it, and in fact, they effectuated their policy by underpricing and overproducing, and through most, a major part of 1981, they were in fact producing almost 10.25 million barrels a day with the obligation of their off-takers to lift and to dispose of that oil. Now, for a while, the preferred off-taker in Saudi Arabia, whether he be an American company or the Japanese, were twice blessed. They were twice blessed with oil in 1980 when other people were short, and with low-cost oil. But by 1981, it became a mixed blessing. What do you do with that amount of oil which is being put upon you at a time when there are surpluses all over the world, demand is going down, refining capacity? But for a while, what you do is you have surplus refining capacity, you put it through your refineries, and you put it through your refineries. Since it's the lowest cost oil in the world, you can sell it competitively. The effect, of course, is to weaken market prices in every major market that Saudi Arab oil reached, whether it was directly or indirectly. It didn't matter whether it actually reached it. The fact is these companies had access to very, very large volumes of low-cost oil. You weaken product prices. After a while, you have no place to go with the product, so the products themselves go into inventory, and after a while, you have no more room for product inventories, and this surplus production goes into crude oil storage. And when crude oil storage is filled, you charter empty tankers, you fill it with crude oil, and you move it to Southeast Asia, into the Caribbean, and you have floating storage. My point is very simple. The Saudis effected their purpose. They forced the more aggressive members of OPEC to come down with their extreme prices, the $41 a barrel that Nigeria was charging and getting away with in 1980. Even at the beginning of 1981, they couldn't hold. They were beginning to lose production, lose exports. They were forced to bring their prices down. And by August, when OPEC met, even though OPEC didn't formalize the reunification of prices that Saudi Arabia had been shooting for, in fact, they had achieved it. They had won their battle. And when Yamani walked out of the OPEC meeting in August of 1981, he said, well, we couldn't agree, but I have a present for OPEC. We're going to reduce our production to 9.5 million barrels a day. Present for OPEC? Nonsense. The off-takers in Saudi Arabia had been screaming ever since the early summer, for heaven's sakes, enough is enough. We have nothing more to do with this crude oil. Saudi Arabia, willy-nilly, and whatever its purpose is, had to reduce their production. And they reduced their production a little further by December of 1981. But I put it to you that when they had done that, they had reduced production too little, they had reduced production too late, and they had reduced production not convincingly enough. Because the statement always was, we are reducing our ceiling on production. They did not say openly and specifically that we are cutting back our production and telling our off-takers that they can't lift more than this particular volume which is going to balance the market. And the upshot was that 1981, as a result of this policy on the part of Saudi Arabia, designed to bring extreme prices down, but carried out through underpricing and overproduction, changed completely the character of the year 1981. We started 1981 with an overhang of inventories of something over 5 billion barrels. Exactly what and how is unimportant. But basically, there was a tremendous overhang of high-cost inventories that confronted the whole world, and everyone anticipated, producing governments, oil companies, governments of oil-importing countries that had to make policy, everybody anticipated that 1981 would be a year of adjustment, the way 1975 and 1976 were years of adjustment, and that inventories would be worked off in the course of the year. But in fact, because of the Saudi Arab policy, there was virtually no liquidation of inventories in the course of 1981. The sum total was maybe at the rate of 1 million, 1.5 million barrels a day, which means inventories were reduced, say, between 350 million and 500 million barrels. And we ended 1981 with inventories of over 5 billion barrels, which is about 100 days supply, which is 20 days more than the rate of inventory carriage which we had in 1978. And it was this which brought us into 1982 with now the accumulation not only of further declines in demand, conservation, and everything else, but an overhang of inventories which had been high cost in 1981, but which became intolerable in 1982. Became intolerable because the conventional wisdom had by then changed around so thoroughly that with surpluses foreseeable into the future, into the foreseeable future, and prices having no way to go but down, you saw the demonstration of it just here, that to carry inventories becomes absolutely intolerable. A barrel of inventories that you have in stock today is going to be worth less tomorrow and still less the day after, so you get rid of inventories. And we had a tremendous rate of inventory liquidation beginning early in January through February, and most of them were product inventories. And a lot of these were product inventories which don't even show up in the inventory statistics because they're secondary inventories held by consuming groups, industry, utilities, and so on.
I just didn't understand. By product, you mean what, like gasoline?
Gasoline, fuel oil, heating oil, inventories of products in the market areas. And with this overhang of inventories, one, whose value is going to go down, two, that you can always replace because there's plenty of surplus refining capacity, there's crude oil whose prices are going to be going down, so you can replace it cheaper than what you had in stock, so you sell the products. On top of that, you can probably buy from somebody else with surplus products, cheaper supplies than running crude through your own refinery. And so you had an essentially a dumping of products onto product markets, and you had tremendous weakness of product prices in all major consuming areas. In the United States, in Western Europe, where losses were being suffered at an incredible rate, Southeast Asia, and so on. And this liquidation of products kept pushing crude oil back into inventory. Because if you reduce your refinery runs and you buy products for somebody else, you're not using crude oil. And so we had, through January and February, very little liquidation of crude oil. And when you hear about the firming of product prices, which took place in March, my own guess is that this was owing less to a major change in the psychology of the market, although there was some concern about what OPEC was going to do, as it was to the fact that the product dumping had very much come to a halt and we were reaching the point where we had to start liquidating crude oil inventories. Well, now we come to the guts of the problem, that here is OPEC sorely beset by the declining demand for their crude, with the dumping of products weakening prices in product markets, so refiners are suffering losses. As refiners suffer losses, they've got to reduce their crude oil costs. And the way you reduce your crude oil costs is to slough off whatever high-cost crude there is, except one. Nobody sloughs off Saudi Arab crude. Why not? Very difficult. Very, very difficult. If Saudi Arabia says our production ceiling is 8.5 million barrels a day, or 7.5 million barrels a day, or 7 million barrels a day, and you are an off-taker from Saudi Arabia, you want to be very, very careful lest you prejudice your future relationships by underlifting what has now become high-cost crude instead of low-cost crude. Because with the Saudi Arabs pricing at $34 and other crudes selling very much below, it's a high-cost crude, and yet one is very, very careful. There was underlifting, but no company is prepared to go too far unless it gets a clear signal from Saudi Arabia. And in the latter months of 1981 and the early part of 1982, Saudi Arabia was not giving a clear signal as to what their intentions were. So what you have now is the dilemma within OPEC of, one, how you balance your production with a demand for OPEC oil, how you preclude or at least reduce the amount of discounting by some of the OPEC members so that you can achieve a modicum of stability in the crude oil market over the months immediately ahead. What does it take to balance? I take a crack at it. There are different groups within OPEC that have had and still have a need for increased production, exports, and oil revenue. There's, first of all, Iraq and Iran. Both of them, before, they used to produce between 9 and 10 million barrels a day. Together, they barely produce as much as 2 million barrels a day at the present time. Both of them desperately in need of volume and revenues to rebuild against the war, which incidentally is still going on. So there's almost an unlimited desire for increasing production, exports, and oil revenues. No matter, they can't do it. There's a limit to how much can be increased out of these two countries. Iraq has lost and will not be able to reestablish its major export facilities at the head of the Persian Gulf as a result of war damage. Whatever they might be able to produce, they cannot move into export more than two pipelines will carry, two pipelines which go to the eastern Mediterranean. One pipeline which goes to Tripoli in Syria, another one which is built through Turkey into the eastern Mediterranean. Together, these two pipelines can carry a little bit more than 1 million barrels a day. Now, there is another pipeline which has on-again, off-again operations through Syria. It's lost some pumping capacity. But if whatever Iraq can produce, the limitation on what they can export is their pipeline capacity. That's going to remain for a very considerable period of time. Iran would love to produce, what, 3-4 million barrels a day, get exports of 3 million barrels a day. They have a very, very serious problem in it. First of all, because there are a lot of off-takers from Iran, their major customers, for example, the Japanese, who rushed to Iran in 1979 when Iran was opening up because they had nationalized and the Americans backed away, was the first chance the Japanese ever had to get direct access to Middle East oil. First chance they ever had, instead of just buying it for the international majors. They rushed in, they paid premium prices and everything else. But of course, Iran went down the drain as a result of the war. The Japanese have opened up extremely important lifting arrangements with Saudi Arabia. The Japanese today, as a group, take as much oil from Saudi Arabia as any one of the four Aramco American oil companies. And one, they would be reluctant to turn their back on that, to reopen negotiations with the Khomeini-dominated Iran. And secondly, the Saudis are in a position, no matter what the Iranian price is, to say to companies, slowly, slowly, by all means, we don't want them to negate the economic reconstruction of our Muslim brothers in Iran, half-brothers. In Iran, but the greatest threat to Saudi Arabia had been the pretensions, the megalomania of the Shah, and I think the Saudis may be as frightened of the pretensions of Khomeini as they were of the Shah, and they're reluctant to see the economic reconstruction too fast. Put it all together, and whatever these two countries may want, it is unlikely that in the near term they will get increased exports of more than about 750, maybe a million barrels a day. Next, Kuwait, Libya. Don't directly need the money, have other reasons for wanting increased exports. they're producing well below what had been their previous peaks. Together today, they must be producing about maybe 1.4, 1.5 million barrels a day. They would like a lot more, but neither of them has crying revenue needs. And if you say that each of them could expect out of an OPEC arrangement in the near term to get another 750,000 barrels a day, this may not make them happy, but it may not keep them so unhappy that they would be price cutters in order to get an additional 100,000 barrels a day or 200,000 barrels a day. And then you have the real have-nots, the other four: Algeria, Nigeria, Venezuela, Indonesia. All of them need revenue, would like to have increased exports. As a matter of fact, the lower the price goes, the higher the level of exports they need in order to maintain the level of revenues, which is one of the devastating things about cutting and discounting prices. But again, I would say that if they were able, as a group, for a time, to increase their exports by another million, 1.2 million barrels a day, they would not be happy, but they would need not be so unhappy that they couldn't stick it out for a while. So what I'm talking about is something on the order of 2.5 to 3 million barrels a day that somehow has to be given to them. Now, that's not going to come, 3 million barrels a day is not going to come out of the Saudi Arab hide. The Saudi Arabs, I don't believe at this present time, are prepared, given the state of the market, to reduce their production by enough so that there would be a shift of offtake from Saudi Arabia to these eight countries in the amount of another 2.5, 3 million barrels a day, although Abu Dhabi might give a little bit or so. So the problem that faced OPEC when they convened in March was a fantastic juggling act. The Saudis had to convince the other eight, that they were serious enough and determined enough that they would reduce actual production, not just their ceiling, to a figure that the others might be able to live with, and then wait till something else happens that improves the whole environment. What would happen to improve the environment? The turnaround from inventory liquidation, which is still going on, the crude oil inventory liquidation, which is still going on, to a lower rate of liquidation, which means, in effect, the world would have to meet its demand, its energy demand, its oil demand, out of current exports from OPEC instead of partly from OPEC and partly out of inventories. Saudi Arabia has to convince the eight that they are serious enough, but the eight had to convince Saudi Arabia that they wouldn't accept what was given to them and then go on cutting prices still further in order to get their extra 100, 200, 300,000 barrels a day. And let me tell you, this is one neat juggling act that has to be performed. That one has to persuade the eight, and the eight have to persuade the one. You know what I mean by a juggling act. There's the story of the young juggler who never always performed the music halls, and God, he couldn't succeed. He just wasn't that good, and he went running back to his agent all the time and kept saying, can't you get me more jobs, can't you get me more jobs? And the agent would say, I'll try, and the juggler would say, well, I'll call you tomorrow. And the agent would say, don't call me, I'll call you. Well, he finally gave up, and one sleepless night he realized that juggling really wasn't his vocation, that the call to God was his vocation. He applied, entered a Catholic seminary, and turned out to be a magnificent student. He graduated, was ordained as a priest, and because of his record, he was one among a small group of novitiates who were called to Rome to meet the Pope. And he knelt before the Pope, and he kissed the papal ring, and the Pope said, my son, what were you before you heard the call of the Lord? And he said, I was a juggler. And the Pope didn't quite understand. He said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. He said, I will show you, Papa. And it was a candelabra next to the Pope with these 4-foot candles all lit. And he took two candles out and he started juggling them. And then he took a third and started juggling them. Then he took a fourth, 4 foot lit candles. He never juggled more than four oranges in his whole life, and finally he had seven lit candles going on all at one time. And at that point, there was a tremendous sound of heavenly music that filled St. Peter's. And he let these candles come down. They fell right into place in the candelabra. The dome of St. Peter's opened up. The music swelled, and the cherub came sliding down this beam of light to the foot of the Pope and the juggler, and he turned to the juggler and said, "Don't call us, we'll call you." Well, this is the problem that confronts OPEC. Now, the question then is whether or not the OPEC decision to hold production to 7.5 million barrels a day is going to stabilize the market. I think it's been discussed here many times that 7.5 million barrels a day is not the answer to anything, really. But it's a holding action on OPEC's part. OPEC knows that the world is using today more than 17.5 million barrels a day. They're using more than that. Therefore, if Saudi Arabia will actually cut production, not just their ceiling, to 7, maybe if necessary, 6.5 million barrels a day, and if the others hold still and tighten their belt and suffer the shortfall in the desired level of exports for how many months? 3, 4, we don't know how many months. But if they do that, then that 7.5 million barrels a day will increase to 19.5 or 20 million barrels a day. Now, that's not going to be frustrated by added conservation or by substitution. We're going to be doing whatever we can anyway in all of these areas. But the turnaround in the rate of inventory liquidation is what OPEC is banking on, and if they are prepared to go that route without continuing to cut prices, then the expectation is that they'll be able to stabilize the market. Stabilize the market where? OPEC, the competition that OPEC faces is not from what was referred to a minute ago as low-cost North Sea crude. If OPEC worries about North Sea crude, the game is lost. And the competition is not from declining prices of U.S. oil. If they worry about that, the game is lost. North Sea oil is not a price maker in this world, and U.S. crude oil is not a price maker in this world. The price maker, the price determining factor in the world, is never the lowest priced oil, lowest cost oil. It's always the highest price, the highest cost. This is what makes prices. You know that consumers, if they need a certain volume of oil, are going to have to pay the price for that, you forgive the use of a term like the marginal barrel. It's a term in economics, but every chief executive of an oil company knows what the marginal barrel is. The marginal barrel is the last barrel you have to buy for your refinery, or it's the last barrel that you get out of your refinery. You're always interested in the cost of the marginal barrel. Well, if OPEC can hold the price for the volume of oil which is required, that will do that. They cannot, if they compete with North Sea oil, I put it to you, no matter what they do with their price, they're not going to drive North Sea oil down underneath the water. And if they cut their prices, they're not going to drive U.S. oil down under the ground of Texas. We're going to produce our roughly 8 million barrels a day of crude oil, and the North Sea, Norway and Britain together, are going to produce their 2.1 million barrels a day of crude oil because they're more concerned about volume than they are about price. But OPEC has to worry about competitive pricing, and that's OPEC countries competing with themselves for this, to try to get their share of what they regard as the deficient demand. It's OPEC competition within itself which is creating, directly or indirectly, the extremely low spot prices, because the dumping of products, which incidentally continues even with some OPEC countries, exporting their crude oil, refining it in third countries, in toll refineries, taking some of the products back and dumping the surplus products onto markets, undercutting prices, losses in product markets, and it comes back to haunt them in terms of their crude oil prices. Now, they know this. Greg Erickson made the point very, very dramatically this morning when he said that in the short run, a reduction in price is not going to increase demand. Now, if they don't know that, they're going to learn it from Greg. It doesn't take very long for this kind of information to spread around. Are they always correct? Are they always intelligent? Are they always incisive in their decisions? We're not. In 1979 and 1980, the countries of the oil importing world and the companies from these countries competed among themselves to bid the price up, ratcheting it up month after month after month. And how many barrels of extra oil do you think this rising price got out of the ground? Not a bloody barrel. Not a barrel, really. What they were doing is competing among themselves for the oil that was not contracted for, that was on the spot market. And the faster they bid up the spot market prices, one country after another withdrew its crude from contracts, put it on the spot market, so the contract prices went up, and after that the official prices went up. And OPEC did a wonderful job of taking advantage of our own short-sightedness. We bid prices up without bringing forth more supply. And what the OPEC members are doing when they compete with each other is they're driving prices down without bringing forth increased demand. Now, they know that. They were driven by circumstances. But all through 1981, they never believed what is so often said, that they're facing the discipline of the marketplace. And it's the discipline of the marketplace which is going to force crude oil prices down. Hell, they never believed it. They don't believe it today. It wasn't the discipline of the marketplace. It was the intransigence of Saudi Arabia.